when I write about Black characters, that isn't quote unquote like easier for me than writing about white people or straight people or people who had money growing up. The difficulty is the same because in all of those instances, I'm having to enter into another person's life and to imagine for them a rich and full human experience.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. My guest today is the novelist Brandon Taylor, who spoke to me from his home in Iowa in November 2020. Brandon is the author of Real Life, which was published in the UK in July last year and later went on to be shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It follows Wallace, who is an Alabama-born man who identifies as queer and is studying for a biochemistry degree at a Midwestern college. Brandon also happens to be an Alabama-born queer man with a biochemistry degree, so we talk a bit about why he was keen to write about science, as well as the challenges of drawing on your own experience. It was Brandon's debut novel, but as you'll hear, he's very prolific and has several books stacked up waiting to come out. The next one will be his first collection of short stories, Filthy Animals, which is out later this year. He explained to me that he comfortably writes 8,000 words per session, which made me feel slightly queasy. If it's making you feel a bit panicky about your own productivity, then hold on until later in the episode when he has some very comforting advice for anyone who's struggling with their fear of the blank page. He's particularly interesting on the question of writing about other ethnicities, people from other backgrounds and sexualities, and why any good writer should be able to summon the empathy to do that well. Before we get to Brandon, I'm very happy to say that this episode is sponsored by Papier. Papier offers a unique collection of customizable stationery created in collaboration with artists and designers. I have several of their beautiful notebooks, and during the first lockdown, I also treated myself to some headed note cards so that I could write to friends and family. I would recommend looking at the Collagerie collaboration. It's colour-blocked stationery designed by former Vogue editors Lucinda Chambers and Serena Hood. For a 15% discount on your first order, visit papier.com and at checkout, use the code InWritingPodcast, all one word. That's papier.com, papier.com, and the code InWritingPodcast. But now back to today's interview, and here's Brandon Taylor.
I didn't realize when my publicist asked me if I would do this that it would fall on Thanksgiving. So it's a bit...
Oh my goodness. You know, that hadn't even crossed my mind. I'm so sorry.
Oh no, it's totally fine.
I'll try and make it as enjoyable as possible to make up for you doing it on Thanksgiving.
I'm looking forward to it.
So where are you now? Are you in the room that you would write in?
I am actually, yeah.
Okay.
I'm in my kitchen / living room.
Would you describe it for me so we can get a sense of like where the magic happens, if you will?
Oh, sure. So I used to do a lot of writing in cafes and things, but since lockdown happened, that's not a thing anymore. And so right at the start of lockdown, I thought, I need a kitchen. I need like a long table to sort of, if I'm going to be in my apartment writing, I can't just like do it on my belly in my bed. So I need like a table. So I purchased this like long-ish dining table and had it shipped to me. And then I bought like some mid-century modern chairs to sort of just like make it feel kind of cozy and homey. And so what I've done is I've put it against like the sort of dividing wall between the living room and the kitchen. And so it's just my long table. And I'm looking at my fridge, my couch is behind me. And yeah, this is where I do all of my writing. I have like stacks of notebooks, old New Yorker copies, printed out manuscripts, lots of pens, a lovely lamp, an automatic stapler, because I love the sort of tactile side of things. I really have to print things out and read them. I'm not good about reading on the computer and stuff like that.
And what are you working on at the moment, writing wise?
So I'm working on a couple of things. Most pressingly, I'm reviewing first pass proofs of my short story collection that comes out next year. I just got those a couple days ago. And I'm also working on a couple new short stories. For the first time in many, many months, I'm writing new fiction. So I'm excited about that. So I'm working on short stories and I'm working on a Southern Gothic novel.
Oh, wow. That's really exciting. So what is your kind of routine when you're writing a book?
Yeah. So the way that it normally works is that I just, you know, I wake up in the morning, I have coffee, I have yogurt, and then I sit at my desk and then I start writing. I open up a Word document and then I just sort of sit down and write and write and write until my attention span runs out. And then I get on Twitter and waste a couple hours there. And then once I've sort of wasted as much time as I feel okay wasting, I go back to work. The drafting is the part I love the most. And so when I'm just in the drafting phase, I can draft for days and days and days with Twitter breaks and dinner breaks and the like. Though sometimes I do forget to eat. I just get absorbed in the writing of it.
Oh, wow. Okay. I mean, I've never forgotten to eat in my life. So that feels like a pretty good attention span you have.
I mean, sometimes. I mean, it's a lot of my friends me how I manage to tweet so much and write as much as I do, and what I learned about myself over the course of like working on books and just working is that I'm not really good about discipline if I'm being really like harsh with myself. And so I think of it as having like porous attention, so like I can drift into and out of focus, and if I find myself being distracted, I'm not going to beat myself up about it. I'm just going to let my attention wane. And then once I feel like I've like relaxed, and then I come back to focusing. I try not to be really harsh with myself, because when I'm really harsh on myself, all I can think about is how I shouldn't be thinking about wanting to not be writing or something like that. Like I get distracted by the fact that I'm distracted. And so I just try not to be too strict with myself. I try to give myself lots of patience and lots of room to be distracted. And so once the distraction ends, then I feel relaxed enough to come back to work. So it's been a like years long process figuring out how my attention span works and how I work and what's best for me.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking, I think I read somewhere that you write fast and you clock up a lot of words in a session.
Yeah. So I didn't realize that I wrote really fast until I started talking to other writers. I think comfortably I can write about 8,000 words a session. If I push myself, I can hit 10,000 words a session. And that's just from like years. I used to spend my summers writing little stories with my friends online, and so we would write thousands and thousands of words a day for each other. And so I just built up, I guess, like a stamina and a speed for writing fiction and things. So yeah, I do write really quickly, and so I can churn out words. I when I think about it, I'm always thinking of it as like I have absolute faith and my ability to produce words. So I try not to be precious about the words I have on the page, because I know that I can always throw them out and make more words. Like I'm never afraid that I'm not going to be able to write more words.
That's great. That's like a superpower. I mean, I was going to say, do you know, if you're writing 8,000 words a day comfortably, are those, you know, how many of those do you consider good words when you look, you know, how much editing are you doing later? Or does it really come out pretty well formed?
It's sort of paradoxical, because I do write a lot of words, and oftentimes the words are quite good. You know, I can write a first draft and send it to my agent or to editors, and they'll be like, this is clean, let's go, let's run with it, let's publish it. And there's that level of it. But I often also am like a really heavy reviser, you know, like I for this book of stories that I'm working on, these stories have gone through so many iterations. Like, many of those stories, I wrote the first drafts and second drafts and published them, and I thought they were pretty good, and, you know, they won online awards and people really liked them. But when it came time to putting them into a book, I had this whole other level of, like, rigor that I wanted to bring to the stories. And so they were quite heavily revised. I'm not too precious. Like, I'm not the kind of writer who thinks I can only write 50 words and I have to chisel them out of a mountain and they have to be perfect when they come. I have a pretty, like, lax attitude when it comes to the words, and I trust my ear and I trust my voice. And usually the work comes out pretty solidly in place the first draft, but I don't let that get in the way of also blowing them up and rewriting them.
Yeah.
For my debut novel, Real Life, you know, I sent the first draft of that book. Literally, I typed the last words, didn't change a thing, sent it to my agent, and then she made me fix like three little typos, and then we sold it, you know,
That's insane. I think there are going to be a lot of very jealous people listening to this.
Well, but the thing is, like, that book, at the time we sold it, I was satisfied with it, but I also knew that there were things in it that I felt like I knew I didn't get right. And so I put a lot of faith in revision. I don't let the fact that I can write a clean or good first draft, like, I'm not satisfied with that. Like, I'm never satisfied with the good draft. I always ask, like, okay, this draft is good enough to get me in the door, but if it's going to go out into the world, it has to be pushed to the furthest I can get it.
Yeah.
And so I revise really heavily. I work really, really hard at revision, even though, and I feel lucky because that often what I'm revising is like a draft that's already really in place. And so then I get to focus on like key beats or key moments in the text. So I'm not distracted, like having to fix the tone or prose. Thank goodness.
Yeah. When do you remember first being interested in writing?
I think I was always interested in writing. I was always making up little stories and writing them down and telling them to my cousins and that sort of thing. So I've always written. I've always been really interested in writing. It's just that I didn't know that writing was a thing you could do. I thought that all the books that existed in the world were like handed down to us from the olden times, and I didn't know people were still writing books. And it wasn't until I got to college that I realized, oh, writing is a job you can have. But it still took me quite a while to get there because I was really passionate about science and stuff. But I think I've always been a writer. I've always written stories and things like that.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking that not everybody in your family was literate when you were growing up?
Yeah. My dad and my mom, my dad could read at like a third grade level or something like that. But he really loved books. He really loved books, but he couldn't really read them. And so I would read them to him. And my mom dropped out of school before she even got to high school because she had my brother quite young. And so my parents weren't really literate. My grandfather was illiterate, and my grandma was she was literate enough to sort of get by, you know, but oftentimes, you know, if they had prescriptions, they would have me or my cousins read them to them so they would know what the side effects were. Or if they had a letter from the government, often it was like me or my cousins, you know, eight, 9-year-olds having to read like government documents for their grownups. It didn't seem strange to me because that was the life I had. That was the family I had. It didn't seem strange until I found out that my friends at school were not reading their parents' confidential government communications and things like that.
So what do your family make of, you know, this career that you've carved out?
I mean, I've always been a bit of an odd duck within the context of my family. And so I think in some ways it's just, I think it's just a continuation of Brandon being an odd duck. my cousin recently, I shared the cover for my upcoming book on Instagram. And one of my first cousins was like, I pre-ordered it for you. I'm going to support you. You're my family. And I felt really moved by that, but also thinking like we had no books in our houses growing up. So yeah. Where are you going to, put this object? they aren't, I don't know if they really know what it means to be a writer, but you know, they've been supportive in their way.
Yeah, that's really touching. So you spent many years as a scientist before you turned to the writing. Were you kind of writing throughout that time?
Yes, I, in undergrad, I took writing classes, of course, and then I went away to get a PhD in biochemistry. And I remember very vividly that first year of my doctorate, I remember making this very conscious choice that I was going to set aside writing and really focus on science because this was my career now. And I thought writing was a thing I did as a naive youth and I'm going to set it aside. And what I found was that it was like really difficult, like because I had been writing my whole life, like writing was a thing that I used to make sense of the world. And putting it aside felt like losing a part of myself. And it was just really, really difficult. Add on top of that, the stress of, you know, graduate school. It was a really difficult year. And so in my second year of graduate school, I started writing again and I started joining little writing groups and things. And I started having some real concrete success with my writing. And then I began to think like, oh, okay, maybe I can do both. I know I obviously can't live without writing because I was just so miserable when I wasn't writing. So maybe I can try to do both. So yeah, I mean, for all of the years, except that first year of my doctorate, I started writing on the side and publishing little essays and little stories and journals and magazines and things.
Yeah. In terms of creative writing programs, I was listening to, I think you were on the Monocle podcast, and I was listening to that and you said you only applied to the Iowa Writers' Workshop because you felt if you didn't get in, then it just wasn't meant to be and you were just going to stick with science. Do you think that that is actually how that would have panned out? Or do you think that you would have looped around to writing again? Because it's clearly, you know, it's clearly so important to you and you're so good at it.
I think that's a great question. I think that you're probably right and that I probably would have come back to writing eventually. But, you know, when it came to time, when I made that decision to apply to Iowa, I thought, you know, my science wasn't going very well for reasons that I later discovered were not entirely all my fault. And I just felt like I was in such a difficult place and I felt all this pressure and I thought, I need to have a backup plan. And what would I want to do with my life? And I realized that it was like the first time in my life that I was making a choice based on what I wanted and not like what I needed to do in order to be a scientist or to be this thing that I'd set out for myself when I was 5 years old. Like I was like, if I had my free will to choose, what would I do if I couldn't be a scientist? And I thought, well, I'd be a writer, but that's such a silly idea. Only so many, like, that just seems so silly. That seems so far-fetched for me. I didn't study English. I don't, you know, I've only been reading quote-unquote seriously for just a short amount of time. And what do I know about writing? But it felt really important to me to make that choice based on what I wanted and not just like what I need to do in order to feed myself or whatever. So those were the things that were going through my mind when I applied to Iowa. And what I mean when I say, if it's not Iowa, it's not worth it to me is that I thought like, well, what are the programs that I would really, really leave science for and that would make a real like qualitative change in my life. And I thought, would I leave science and would I enter into all of the precarity and strangeness and uncertainty of a writing career for a program that didn't have, you know, the reputation of Iowa, but also like the program that, you know, many of my favorite writers went through that program. You know, it wasn't just the prestige that made me decide on Iowa. It was the fact that Alexander Chi, who's an important writer to me, had gone to Iowa, and Garth Greenwald had gone to Iowa, and Justin Torres had gone to Iowa. Like the few writers who had become, not mentors exactly, but important people to me, who had sort of helped me on the journey, like they had all gone to that program. And I thought, that is the place I want to learn to be a writer, because that's the kind of writer I want to be. And so that's why it was so important to me to apply to Iowa. And the other part of that is like MFA programs are difficult to apply to. There are so many like papers you have to sign. There are letters of recs you have to track down. There's money involved. You have to like print and collate your writing samples. It's a lot of work. And I was like, I don't want to do all this work. I'm going to just pick one program and I'm going to bet it all. And if it's not meant to be, it is not meant to be.
Yeah. It's funny because I think you are maybe the 24th interviewee that I've had on this podcast, but you're the third person who has been through the Iowa Writers' Workshop. It looms so large. Mm.
I think one of my classmates was on the podcast, Kylie Reed. Our very first workshop we had together at Iowa, we were classmates.
Wow, that's a very successful class then.
Yeah, I mean, there were three of us on the Booker long list this year. It was surreal.
That is crazy. And am I right in thinking that you had already written the book when you got there?
Yeah. So I had written my story collection and the first draft of Real Life before I got to Iowa.
So then I hope this doesn't sound like a rude question. What did you get out of Iowa having already, you know, did it help you in terms of reviewing what you'd written or?
My friend Pam Zhang and I, we often ask ourselves the same question. Oftentimes when we were still students, we're like, why are we here? This is so stressful. I applied to Iowa because I felt like I wanted an education. I felt like I'd been trying to figure out how to be a writer and what writing was by myself. I felt like I was lost in the wilderness and I wanted to find a place to come in, you know, come into out of the wilderness and to figure out how to be a writer and to be among other people who cared as much as I did about books and writing and language and words. And so that was my impulse to apply to Iowa. And once I got there, I immediately realized, oh, I definitely do not want to put either of these books up for workshop. I want to use this program as like a prompt to make new work, and that I want to work really hard and really diligent to get a book out of this program when I graduate. And so I went there both for the structure, and also to be around other people who cared about writing, because I'd been around scientists and for like 4 or 5 years, and I was ready to like be around some book people.
Sure. And was there an element as well of like, once you had been accepted into the workshop, you know, when you were working on Real Life, knowing that you had been accepted onto the most prestigious writing workshop, was there a sense of validation of you as a writer that maybe helped with the writing of Real Life? Maybe I'm just projecting how I would see it, but.
Oh, maybe. It's sort of strange because I always think of it as Real Life came before Iowa, but that's not entirely true. Because I started Real Life in April, and I was accepted to Iowa in February. And so like Real Life certainly did come after I'd been accepted to Iowa, but I didn't even think about Iowa one little bit while I was working on the novel. I was writing the novel. I mean, actually I was writing the novel at the time to get this literary agent off my back, but he would let me write short stories. And so that's what I was thinking of when I was working on the novel. I wrote the novel after I had decided that I would go to Iowa, but I wasn't thinking about Iowa while I was working on the novel. I was really just so focused on getting to the end of a book, because the only thing I'd gotten to the end of was a story collection, and it felt really important to me to get to the end of a novel to see if I could, and hopefully I could, so my agent would take me seriously. But I do think that once I got to Iowa, I think that it was really, even though I had a really difficult time there and it wasn't the best time of my life, and I don't think I actually learned anything technically in the classroom, I think it was the best place for me to be after I wrote the novel, because once I finished Real Life, I didn't write fiction for like 5 months. I just had felt like I had used up everything. And I feel like if I had still been working in science, I might never have come back to myself. Like, I might never have come back to writing, because it was, because I didn't know to have faith that I would write again. But since I was at Iowa, I was surrounded by all of these people who had written books and who were still writing. And so it gave me hope. And also because I was in a writing program, I had to produce material to workshop for class. It's a part of the training model. And so it was like this goad to get back to work and to get back to writing. And even though I didn't learn anything about like technique or craft from my teachers exactly, what I did learn was this, and I think that this is true of all of the teachers I had, even the ones I disagreed with like really passionately, what I think those teachers all gave me was a sense of the most important thing is the work, and validation is nice, but it is subordinate to the work. And what you must do when you finish a story is turn the page and begin again.
Do you ever miss science?
Oh, I had this intense postpartum period where I was like, oh, I never want to think about science again. But I just recently, I was thinking, if I had known the last time I was going to do a bacterial transformation and microinjection, if I had known that that was the last time, I would have enjoyed it a little more. there are moments when I miss it really profoundly. There are days when I miss the atmosphere of lab. I miss the collaborative nature of the work. I even miss going up for lab presentation day. I miss being torn apart by my peers and put back together again. Because sometimes writing can feel so solitary, and you write a story and you show it to your agent and your agent's like, oh, that's nice. But in science, you do all this work, you put together this presentation, and people have 15 questions for you. They have like 15 questions about like one little slide you've put together. And so I miss that intense feeling of like interrogation and thinking through a complicated problem as a group. And so I do miss that part of it. I miss all of the good stuff and the intellectual exercise of it. And also just like the feeling of wonder I had every time I looked into my microscope. I loved that. And yeah, so I do miss it quite a lot. But I also know that nostalgia is dangerous. And just, and it was actually not a very pleasant time in many ways.
Yeah. I was really interested in how you write about science in the novel, because you have this protagonist, Wallace, who you have like long passages of, especially near the beginning of the book, I think you have quite long passages of very technical description of what he's working on. And I have to be honest, I'm completely unscientific. And so all I could tell you is that worms are involved, that's dissecting. But I thought that was a really interesting choice that you decided not to kind of shy away from that for stupid readers like me who might not be able to follow the ins and outs of it, but to kind of lean into it. And why was that important to you?
This is so interesting. I was just, before I did this interview, I was just tagged on Instagram in a review of the book, and the person was very complimentary. They liked the book a lot, but they said, I don't know why he would write a whole chapter about biochemistry. Lost on me. I'm sure there's a reason, but I don't understand it. And I thought, well, like, the whole book is about that, right? Like, it's all about the biochemistry. It was important to me because I've read and loved a lot of campus novels or books about writers. And I've read many lovely passages in which art is described and the making of art is described and all of this other stuff. And I thought, I wish someone would do that for science, because science is so much like art. I think every process has its arcane bits. But to me, science and poetry and sculpture and art and music, they all are the same thing to me. You know, they all flow from this deeply human need to make sense of the world and the universe and our place in it. And it just felt like an opportunity to take the reader by the hand and to show them all the sort of little seemingly mundane bits and how and why these people find meaning in it. You know, I think, like, yes, I could have written a kind of more detached, like very loose, discursive style in which I sort of skipped over all the boring bits about dissection, though I really love dissection. Like, I could have done that and it would have been a stylish, kind of superficial bit about science. But to me, that would have felt false, because how else will the reader know why these people do what they do? Like I always feel that when I was in workshop, people would always ask, well, if this character is so miserable, why don't they just change their situation? And I hate questions like that. I hate when the reader doesn't have access to why a character persists in an uncomfortable situation. And so it would have felt false to me. It would have felt misleading. It would have felt like the reader would have asked, well, if he's so unhappy, why is he even doing science? Why doesn't he go be a poet or something? And so it was this twofold impulse. One, I wanted to show the world how beautiful science is and how much like art it is. And nobody ever gets cranky when there are 15 page descriptions of a painter stretching a canvas or a writer sort of struggling with a sonnet. Like, nobody thinks of that as being extraneous to the point of the story.
Yeah.
So why should science be any different when it's the same? It's like an activity that a person does in the pursuit of constructing knowledge. It's the same thing. And so, yeah, that's why I did it. But also, as a person who is obsessed with process, you know, process as plot and process as character, I love esoteric processes. I can't get enough of it. I really, really love it. And so it was my love letter to process and to science, and also, like, hopefully illustrating why these people do what they do and what they get from it.
You have this very, very moving and effective chapter right in the middle of the book that stands out stylistically, but it's also crucial to the, it's kind of the moment that the book hinges on, I think. And certainly the character of Wallace, it's such a revealing chapter. Would you talk a little bit about that as kind of a device?
Certainly. So, you know, when I set out to write the book, I knew a few things about the structure. Like, I knew that I wanted to set it over the course of a weekend. I knew that I didn't want a lot of, like, backstory to take up too much space. And I knew that I wanted, you know, the first and last chapter to have this kind of rhyming action between them. And I knew that right in the sort of geographical center of the book, I wanted there to be this hyper-lyric Faulknerian monologue. I wanted there to be this register break. And I wanted that section to contain all of the stuff that Wallace couldn't say or didn't want to think about in all the other parts of the book. Like, it was meant to contain the most urgent, vital, painful stuff about his past and who he was. And so I knew that it was coming. And so I imagined myself when I was writing as like writing up to that moment. And I thought, once I get to that moment, the book will relax and open up and everything will start to merge and blend together. And so then I thought the back half of the book will be this kind of glide down into complication. So I knew I sort of had this stage for myself that I built. And so I wrote through the first four sections of the book really quickly. And then I got to the middle section and just like could not begin it. I had no idea how to even enter into such a register. I always describe it as like having the worst case of stage fright, because you've like built the occasion that you have to perform upon, but you can't bring yourself to do it. And I really thought the book was just going to die there, because the book doesn't work without it. And I was so afraid and so nervous. And then, you know, after like a week of not being able to write, or 2 weeks or whatever, I thought, you know, I was coming home from a potluck with my friends and I was in an Uber, and this line came to me. There were storms all the time. And I thought, that is the first line of the section. And so then I got home, it was like the middle of the night. I sat at my desk and I wrote that whole section in like one heat. Because I felt like if I stopped, I would not be able to begin again. I just needed to keep going. And so everything about Wallace's past just comes out in this almost soliloquy. And there's like a shift from like third person to first person. A lot of things just happened in that section. But yeah, it was meant to be this kind of like open beating wound in the book. Like it's when all of Wallace's defenses get ripped open and he just tells you in a direct way as possible, like who he is and why he is the way he is and what he's afraid of and what he's hoping for the future, and all this other stuff just pours out of him.
Yeah. I mean, because you've done that switch from third person to first person, it feels like the most intimate part of the book, because suddenly we're in Wallace's mind as he's recalling it. And also it's so atmospheric. I was really stirred by the descriptions of the storms of his childhood and the way the ants would swarm on animals that had been killed by the storms. And it's just so beautifully done, the whole passage.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it was difficult. It was really, I mean, it was the most challenging material to write. And it meant going to some really dark and difficult places in my own life. And it was just really, it was a real challenge. And I thought, you know, either this is going to work or it's not. But I cannot even, I can't even look at this again. I had to edit that section through like my hands over my eyes. Actually, editing that section was really difficult. I called a friend. I had him read it to me, and then I told him the changes I wanted to make, and then he made them for me, and then he sent it back, and then I sent it to my editor. Yeah, no, it was just like really, it was so difficult. It was, it to me is like the most difficult part of the book, and it's like touching a live wire. I can barely even stand it.
Yeah. For real life, you drew on your own experiences, as you've said. How does that affect how you then go about approaching a second novel? Are writers, to some extent, always drawing on their own experience, even if it's like not as direct as that? Or did you have any kind of fear of, well, I've told this story that was important to me personally, like what next?
I mean, I don't have that fear. You know, this first book I wrote, I felt like I started this novel because I wanted an agent to take me seriously, and I put all this stuff into it. And like I said, I didn't write for a long time after I wrote it because I felt like I'd used up all the material in my life. And what I found was that my writing got better when it became interested in more people. It got more interesting to me as a writer. And so I feel like I'm still telling stories that are important to me, but they're important to me for different different reasons. You know, like the thing that drives me is this desire to tell stories about queer Black people and to tell stories for queer Black people and to put people into stories like the people I love most in the world and the people that I spend all my time with, you know, my friends and things. And so I'm always drawing, in some sense, like, if not on my experience, then on my observations about the world. And that's the lens that I see the world with. And so I'm always trying to write for my friends and for myself. And even though the books I'm working on now aren't necessarily drawn up from my own life experience in a direct way as real life, I do feel like I'm still telling stories that are deeply, deeply personal and deeply important to me. And it's just, you know, the one-to-one correspondences are hidden. You know, they're not as legible to people. Although I will say that the Southern Gothic novel I am working on is in many ways more autobiographical than real life. And it is just much more difficult to write for that reason. Like, it is writing about what it's like to have the kind of family I have and to be from the kind of place I am from. So that book, which is many books down the line from now, is incredibly difficult to write because I'm going back to a much more personal place, I think. But the novel, the two novels I have coming after my story collection, those two novels are also set in the Midwest. One of them is set explicitly in Madison, Wisconsin again. And there are parts of myself in all of the characters in those books. It's just that the questions that animate that novel are as important and central to my life as the questions that animate real life. But the legibility, I think, to readers will be lower. Like, the reader won't be able to say, oh, this is Brandon's fascination with this or Brandon's that. It's hidden. And yeah, and I think that part of that is me maturing as a writer and just getting better. And also part of it is, like, I've told the direct story, and so now I have to tell the oblique ones.
Yeah. You wrote an amazing essay for Literary Hub, because I'm doing a creative writing course at the moment, and my teacher sent us off to read this, and I absolutely loved it. It's called "There Is No Secret to Writing About People Who Do Not Look Like You," and I'll paraphrase what I think your argument is, and you can correct me if I'm misrepresenting you, but essentially you argue that writing about people of other ethnicities or whatever it is, other backgrounds, comes down to empathy and whether you can put yourself into somebody else's shoes. And if you can't do that, then you shouldn't be writing at all, because that's kind of crucial to being a good writer. And I just found that such a useful way of looking at writing. Empathy was not, you know, I'm ashamed to say, it hadn't really occurred to me that empathy was the thing. But once you tap into that and start thinking about your characters as humans and how people behave in different situations and subject to the experience of life that they've had, I think that's such a useful tool for a writer.
Thank you. I wrote that essay so long ago that I sometimes forget that it still exists. yeah, I mean, it's... And in some ways, I feel like my understanding of that quote-unquote issue has deepened and changed in some way, but I feel like even my own understanding of that, the question of how do you write about people who are different from yourself, even though I feel like, yes, I would use different language now, the point is very much the same. I do really, really believe that, you know, like, when I write about Black characters, that isn't quote-unquote, like, easier for me than writing about, like, white people or straight people or people who had money growing up. For me, the difficulty is the same, because in all of those instances, I'm having to enter into another person's life and to imagine for them a rich and full human experience. And that is difficult to do. That's hard to do. And I think that sometimes, you know, what frustrated me when I wrote that essay was that a lot of the discourse, when it comes down to writing across difference, it seemed to boil down to, well, I'm Black, so writing Black characters is somehow easy, and you're white and you can't do it because you were born differently or you don't have that experience. And I just think, like, well, no, it's not easier. Like, writing is hard, like, period. It is difficult to do well. And it feels like a bit of an excuse to say that because you don't have that lived experience, then you can't do that, because it presupposes that the people who do have that lived experience, that all they have to do is sit down and jot down what they did on Tuesday, and like that is the extent of their craft. And I just don't believe that. I think that every writer sitting down to write well must begin with the question of other minds and other lives and how do you enter into it. I think that there are things that make it easier for you to imagine other people, and for all of us those things are different, and the kinds of people we can't imagine easily are different. But at the end of the day, the job is to create a reasonable facsimile of a human life, and that process is difficult. It's hard to do, and it involves, I think, a fair degree of empathy and a fair degree of really deep engagement with the matter of other lives. And it just frustrates me when people think that it's easy somehow for me, for example, to write like a queer Black character. Like, that is not easy. Like, all of the characters I write, I take them and their lives so seriously, and I work so hard at my desk to make them feel full and human and real, because it is important to me to write well. That to me is what writing well is. It's, can you create a real human experience for these characters, or are you just relying on secondhand strategies and tropes and like cardboard cutout humans? And if so, why is that your impulse to do that?
Real Life is shortlisted for the Booker Prize. So your first novel shortlisted for the Booker Prize. What are the kind of mechanics and the experience of that like being swept up into that kind of Booker list machine?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, as someone who, longtime watcher of literary prizes, and I love to speculate with all my friends, and we make, you know, predictions, and it's a lot of fun. And so I did that for many years. And I thought, like, well, I know book prizes. I will be able to handle this once I found out I was longlisted. And I was totally wrong. I was so wrong. They work us so hard. And so what I found was that when I was longlisted, suddenly, you know, it becomes clear that, like, a lot of people pay attention to this prize, and this prize means a lot to a lot of people, and everyone has their feelings about it. They have their baggage about it, and they are not shy about projecting that onto you. And they often see you as like a symptom of degradation.
Oh, wow.
People felt very strongly about both the longlist and the shortlist, which, as is their right to feel. And so I found it. And also just like the events that you have to do. There's so many interviews, and suddenly everybody wants to talk to you, and suddenly everybody has an opinion about what you're saying, and you have to, I found myself putting up a bit more of a shell than I normally would. And it became clear to me that like the outward facing part of the writer's life takes up so much more space than I thought it would. I used to be such a, I was just talking to my friend Alex about this. I told him I used to be such a brat when writers would announce their tour and they were only doing like 5 events, and I would think, why don't you come here to my city? I want to see more writers. But now I totally understand why writers are so tired.
Yeah.
It's such a demanding and rigorous schedule. It's quite demanding. And you know, I mean, not to sort of make this sound like a problem, it's not a problem. It's, I mean, an immense honor. And I felt so lucky, but there were moments when I felt really exhausted, really tired. And there are moments when I thought I would never write again because I was going to be on the publicity tour for so long. I think the one thing that's changed the most in my perception is that I used to think like, ooh, there's like a secret strategy to literary prizes, and this person's doing this and this judge is doing that. And now that I've sort of been through that experience, what I think is that literary prizes are judged by people who love books and love stories, and that there is no secret agenda and that there is no secret calculus. It's just people who love books and have their own particular tastes and have their own particular criteria selecting books and encouraging people to read them. And it's, yeah, I feel much less cynical about the whole thing now that I've experienced it from the other side.
That's really nice. And when you talk about all the publicity that you've been doing this year, I feel even worse about the fact that you're talking to me on Thanksgiving. Like, I'm so sorry about that. What a miscalculation.
No, it's great. I'm having a lot of fun.
What have you, can you think of something that you have learned over the years that has improved your writing?
Yes. So the thing that changed my life was when I was living in Madison, Wisconsin, my roommate was this friend of mine we went to undergrad together and we knew each other. We were in the same friend group. I went to Madison a year before he did, and I went to study science. And then he applied for rhetoric, just applied and got in and came. And I was like, we have to be roommates. And so I got to be roommates with one of my friends, another queer Black man from Alabama. It was like, I felt like I was home again. It was so good. But he studied rhetoric and composition. And in our first year of living together, the thing that just like unlocked my brain and the only way that I was ever able to write anything, let alone a book of stories and a novel, was when he told me I was really struggling to write. And he said, Brandon, like, why are you so afraid to write? It's just a draft. Just draft. You know how to revise. And it sounds really silly, but him saying, like, it's just a draft, like, unlocked my brain. And so I stopped being precious and I just started drafting. I just started writing. And I've been writing ever since. I feel like in some ways I got on the horse. He put me on the horse when he said it's just a draft, and I've been on it ever since. Like, it just, it. And so that is the thing that I've learned that has like had the greatest impact on my writing life, is this ability to say it's just a draft and to sit down and just to work and to write and to get the words out. It doesn't matter what it sounds like or what it looks like. If you trust your ear and if you trust that you're on the right track, just like let the words do what they will do and believe in your ability to make more words. There will always be more words.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like that is made to be a kind of inspirational quote on an Instagram feed for writers. What are you proudest of as a writer?
The thing that I am proudest of as a writer is, I guess, like two things, but they're related, is the day my book came out, one of my closest friends called me because he had gotten it and he'd read it. I did not send him an ARC because he wouldn't have read it then. He waited until it came out and he bought it and he read it, and he said that he felt so seen and so validated by the character of Wallace. And he felt like for the first time in reading a book, he felt like he wasn't having to do all this extra work of having to figure out like, what's it like to be middle-aged or white or whatever. Like, he just felt like he could just fall right into a character. And hearing that from him and hearing that from other queer Black people, particularly queer Black people in academia, feeling like I got something right and that I gave them a book that they could hold up and say, like, this is how it feels for me, that is the thing that I feel most proud of. You know, the Booker shortlist is fantastic and I love that. I feel honored, but I wrote this book for my people and that they got it and they understood it and they felt like it was true. It just, that means the most to me. And seeing the book become a part of conversations around inequities in academia and inequities in society, that has been incredibly humbling and incredibly moving. And it is the thing I feel most proud of.
A big thank you to Brandon Taylor for that chat. The essay that we were talking about there is called There Is No Secret to Writing About People Who Do Not Look Like You, and I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes. I'm now an affiliate of bookshop.org, which works to financially support local independent bookshops. I've put together an in-writing shop with books written by guests on the podcast, including Brandon. You can find his novel Real Life there. I've also started a list of my favourite books about writing and creativity. You can see all that at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, and I'll put that URL in the show notes as well. Or you can just go to bookshop.org and search for my name and it should come up under shops. I get 10% commission on anything you buy, so by purchasing from my shop, you help me to keep making the podcast. So thank you very much for that. But more importantly, 10% goes into a pool which is distributed among independent bookshops. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it online or send it to someone who you think might like it. Thanks for listening. See you next week.